Hi, my name is Jonathan Myberg, and I'm the singer for Shearwater. There's been seldom been a truthful interview given in rock and roll history, I don't think, and this won't be one of them either.
So tell me some stuff. Give me like the bullet points, but not in the bio way. Because there was some pre-Shearwater, for sure.
There was. I mean, the Shearwater started up sort of around 1999, but didn't really get going as the band as we know it now until about 2005.
That's 6 years. Wow, you could have developed like an app in that time.
Well, there was a training period, you know, and a lot of bands go through that and then change their name and start something else, but we happened to keep the name. But to me, the record, the first record that really is a Shearwater record is Palo Santo, which is the 2006 record that we put out on Matador. So we did that, and then two records that followed it, Rook and The Golden Archipelago. And those three records kind of formed this trilogy that was preoccupied with sort of people's place in the natural world and the strange islands and places that I'd been to in the course of my travels and research as a bird scientist and general sort of wanderer. And then we got to the end of that, and we punctuated that by playing this big show last year where we played all three records back to back as one giant piece here in Austin. And it was this great big epic thing. And at the end of that, I kind of felt like, okay, that's done. We need to take a different approach. And so for this new record, we kind of reinvented the band in a lot of ways. Worked with a different producer on a different label and went for a very different sound and for me, a different style of songwriting.
Now, was that just, bands do that for many reasons. They do it, you know, in your case, you don't probably have to, but you know, some bands do it because their record company calls them up and says, okay, you owe us album number 6. Album number 3 sold really well. Album number 4 did okay. And album number 5, you got experimental. And you know, experimental is just not making it on the playlists of modern rock radio these days.
I'm restless, and I always feel like I can do better. And I felt like we'd reached the end of that particular kind of approach. I mean, the last record, the cover of the last record looks like this. I don't know if you've seen it. It has this cloaked figure in a canoe sailing towards this beautiful, weird-looking island off in the distance. And that's what that record sounds like to me. It sounds like a beautiful object contemplated in the distance. And I didn't really want to get any further away than that. For this record, I wanted it to be more like the cover of the record you're looking at there, which is this beast charging right at you. And I wanted something much more immediate and visceral. And I didn't want the huge spaces. I wanted a closeness and a heartbeat.
We're going to go out of order here because since I purposely brought this. I didn't bring everything for the bands I'm interviewing, but I had to bring this. I have a 10-year-old daughter, and I kind of showed her this, and she goes, "There's something not right about those leopards, Daddy. There's something about them that just feels a little," I said, "scary."
The thing that's great about these images is that they look very alive, but they're in fact all taxidermy.
I kind of figured that.
But when you first look at them, they don't quite look that way.
And that would be why the poor leopard.
Yeah, they have those are cheetahs, I think.
Are those cheaters?
Yeah. Cheaters?
Cheaters? They're cheaters.
Cheetos.
Don't you say that here in Austin? Cheaters?
I don't know.
We got some cheaters here.
Oh, we've got some gibbons over on one side here, and then the African dogs on the other, and it's
all taxidermy.
Yeah, it's all.
And you took the poor taxidermy animals and you put them out in the wild.
Yeah, exactly. It's just there's a. I really like playing with tension in our music, with that sort of different currents that cut in opposite ways. I think it's always wonderful to have something that's beautiful alongside something that's ugly, or something that's very driving and rhythmic against something that's very lyrical. I just think it's more like the way life actually is. And for me, these very alive-looking animals that also happen to be dead animals was kind of a neat tension to play with in the cover.
One of the themes that comes up again and again is that my favorite music is stuff that sounds all warm and fuzzy, but if you listen to the lyrics and you really pay attention, it's kind of like it would be the lollipop, except the Tootsie Roll on the inside is arsenic. You made the change from the trilogy, and yet the irony from moment one,
yes,
is there in the title of the record, wouldn't we say?
Yeah, I mean, I like that title because it cuts so many different ways. I mean, Animal Joy is one of the ways that Tennessee Williams describes Stanley Kowalski. But it's also, I mean, the record is meant to evoke the moments in your life when you feel that your blood is running closest to the surface, and you feel the most alive and your heart is beating the fastest. And those aren't necessarily pleasant moments always. Sometimes they are. But they're the times when I feel like we're most like the animal world that we came from and still belong to, even if we don't acknowledge it a lot of the time. With this record, I wanted to make a record that would be appealing, kind of for fun, but also because I think that in order for something to be accessible, what you try to do is explore the parts of your own psyche that you share with everybody. And if you can do that successfully, then, you know, it can be appealing in a genuine way as opposed to a way that's forced. I mean, for this record, I looked a lot more into sort of my own life and my own emotional life than I had in the last couple of records. And it was something that was really hard to do, but it was ultimately very rewarding. The result was that I feel these songs more when I perform them than I have some other songs in the past.
Here you are as a, quote, Austin band, but do you feel like an Austin band? And is there anything in that's kind of gotten sucked into the sound that affects where you are, or is it pretty much irrelevant?
Well, my answer to that is usually that Texas is bigger than you think.
Right.
There's room for a lot of different kinds of things here. And, you know, just because you're a band from Austin doesn't mean you have to have ripping blues solos or anything like that. Yeah. Or yeah, whatever that is.
It's that grind.
I mean, Texas is so huge that, you know, it encompasses, like, you know, these beautiful verdant marshes and forests in the east all the way over to the absolute Martian moonscape of places like Big Bend with blue-throated hummingbirds and jaguarundis. And you know, it's a very wild and strange place with a lot of different energies and environments and emotion and a huge emotional life. So I think there's room for a lot of different kinds of music to be authentically Texan, I would say. Although, you know, for me, I'm not from here. I lived here for a long time, and I'm from the Southeast in general. But the places that I feel like really inform my music are mostly, honestly, not here. They have more to do with some of the crazy places I've been able to go in my travels, like the Falklands or,
right.
You know, the Chatham Islands off New Zealand or Baffin Island up in the Arctic.
But you didn't record this in various hotel rooms while on tour. This is a gorgeous sounding record. This is a crafted record, and despite the fact that we're talking about, you know, casual and all of that, I get the feeling that you want to really, you know, and I use this term, not like the mafia, but you actually want to make a record. And not people, and you know, there's people that still make records, and then there's people that make records, you know?
There's all kinds of different approaches that can work. I mean, you can make a record in a room in a day, and it can be good. But, you know, I really enjoy making these sort of more classical kind of, you know, really crafted, labored over records where you've, your hope, the risk is that you can end up refining the life out of it. You can preserve a natural musical life within it by focusing on it really hard, which I think you can do with practice. The result, you know, can be this, you know, a wonderful hi-fi, deep, rich. It's funny, these days you have to think about, of course, the way people listen to music. Now mostly people are listening to music through computer speakers and earbuds, which means if you want your record to sound good, you have to think about the way people are hearing it. There are traps to avoid, of course, but like, you know, all that old Motown stuff that they used to mix on, you know, through car radios and things, to because that was the way it was going to be heard. And that stuff sounds great.
And the bass on that was just phenomenal.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, this time there's actually a lot less low end, for instance, in this record than there was in the previous one, but the bass is paradoxically much more present than on previous records.
Because of the way it was mixed.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell me about the producer.
Well, our producer is Danny Reich, who's actually playing drums for us right now. He's a guy from here in town who I'd worked with on a few live recording projects and a 7-inch, and we just got on so well that I was like, you know, I think I just want to work with this guy.
Where did you record it?
In a couple of studios here, mostly at Danny's house, which the Daytrider guys are using actually right now.
Oh, wow.
But it's not just somebody's house, it's a pretty proper recording environment. And also a studio called Texas Tree Fort, which is a beautiful room and a great piano and that kind of thing. But you only want to use that for a few days because it's an expensive clock that's ticking when you use that kind of place. And then after we worked on it for a few months, we took it up to Peter Kadis up in Connecticut.
Yeah, exactly.
And Danny was a big fan of Peter's, so he was excited to work on that with him. And Danny came along, so the two of them worked on it some together.
Well, that's where the final lush comes in, isn't it?
It is.
He's kind of the king of lush, is he not?
He's really good at making these very densely layered recordings that where you can still hear everything and it's very pleasant, even though it's also pushed pretty hard. I mean, he uses a lot of compression stages, but he's very careful about it. But Peter, though, I have to say, said when we played him the rough mixes that we had, on the first day that we went up there, he kind of sat there for a little bit and he said, guys, I have to tell you, this is better than about 90% of what I get in here most of the time. So I'm going to have to work really hard to make it good.
To prove that I am the ultimate mixer that I'm supposed to be.
So we really put him through his paces, and it was a great experience. It was just really, really fun. But Peter brings, you know, a special kind of expertise and a really great musical sensibility to what he does.
When you're on a Matador, do you still get your freedom along with, like, the big distribution? Because they do have good distribution and all of that. Is that... Are there any trade-offs when you do that, when you go to a bigger indie label?
Nope.
So that's great. So you get your cake and you eat it too.
You do. I would say in the case of both Matador and Sub Pop, they pretty much let us do exactly what we wanted, made no suggestions, asked no questions.
So what was the transition from Matador? Was it that the trilogy was over and you said, I'm going to make a change in everything? Or was there some definitive, and I'm not looking to get into contractual A&R, you know, kind of nonsense. I'm more interested in, you know, how did you end up on Sub Pop? Both great labels.
Well, it's funny. Matador actually requested demos for this record. And I thought, fine, that'll make me actually do some work at a time when I should do it rather than waiting till the last minute. So I made a set of demos that were really rough, like super kind of lo-fi, just me with a drummer and an electric guitar in a crappy practice room. And I was very happy with how they sounded. They had this vitality to them that I loved. And I sent them off to Matador thinking, oh, this is great. And Gerard loved them, but everybody else could not get it. And so they dropped it.
Really?
Yep.
So what? Scratching. This is video on audio. Scratching my head again. Didn't get it.
Yeah, I don't know.
What? Really? Yeah. So they just call you up and say, and then that's kind of different because major labels just say, okay, get a new producer. You know, yeah. Right? That's what the majors do.
Well, I have to say, Matador has been nothing but cool to us. They were always really good with us when we were with them, and then like the moment that they said we're not going to work with you anymore, you know, they're like, you were completely free and clear. They let us use live recordings of stuff that, you know, they have rights to and sell it ourselves without taking any of the profits. So I got nothing but good things to say about Matador Records. I ran into Jonathan Poneman at a festival in Poland earlier in that year, and he came up behind me in the way that he does and kind of said, I think you only got one record left in your contract. And I was like, come on, you're kidding me. And
how does he know this?
Because he's all-knowing. I was very happy to see that logo on our record. I'll say that much. I never thought I'd be that lucky. And as far as that label goes, we're still in the honeymoon period with them, kind of, but it's been really a great relationship. They're very organized. They're on top of it. They seem to like one another. You know, I notice, like, in email chains that they're often congratulating one another for things, and it seems to be genuine. And they're just a lot of good feeling around the office, as far as I can tell, or they're putting on a really good act for us.
So what is it like to play songs from a record that is this new?
For one thing, the record, of course, doesn't feel new to me because I finished it back in September.
Right.
And but also we have an all-new lineup for this year touring, which has put a huge shot of energy into the band and into my feeling about the band, for sure, which is not to slight in any way the people that we've been working with or that I've worked with for the last 12 years, including Kim and Thor, who are sitting this year out. But it's just been fun to be with people who have not done big tours before, you know, for whom this really is a novel experience. Kim, we just saw Kim in Boston. She's just recently gotten married and has a job she likes a lot. And I think the idea of getting in a van for 150 shows for no money all year, you know, might not have sounded as appealing as it might once have. And then Thor had been in a tour van with the Swans for 18 months. And I think he would have done it, but I also think there was a part of him that really wanted to stay here and do some carpentry, do some gardening, and live life outside of a tour van. You know the Swans.
Yes.
Or Swans, rather.
Yes.
That is intense music, and Thor played it every night for a very long time. So I think he was a little bit frazzled.
I've invented this thing called a musical sandwich, and it's two of your songs as the bread, and then songs by anybody else you want to play in between.